Welcome to this special edition of the Ravencast. I'm Suzanne Ross, your host for this conversation with Professor Paul Dumochel. Professor Dumochel is a Raven favorite, and we're delighted to welcome him back to the Ravencast. Welcome back, Paul.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, well, it's a delight. We really appreciate you being here. You are professor of philosophy at the Graduate School of Core Ethics and Frontier Sciences at
Ritz-Umaikan. Just like the Ritz Hotel, Ritz-Umaikan
University in Kyoto, Japan. And you're joining us from Kyoto.
Right.
You are one of the leading scholars working with mimetic theory and political theory today. And you gave a keynote address at the Cover Conference this summer, which was really kind of launched the conference, which the theme was After Truth. And you gave a wonderful talk on self-deception and lying. And I hope that will come up in our conversations today.
Okay.
I like to call my conversations with you reality checks. Reality checks with Paul Dumochel, because you tend to cut through all the static that surrounds a lot of these political issues today and really take us to the heart of what's important and what really matters the most. So what I did was I invited you to come and talk about reactions to what's going on in the United States and since the midterm elections here, which were in November. It's a month ago, I guess, now.
I think it's less than a month, isn't it?
It's less than a month, yeah.
It's been less than a month since the midterm took place.
Since the midterms. And, you know, President Trump wasn't on the ballot, but he kept insisting that the election was all about him. So I thought we could take a look at what he's been doing recently and some of your reactions to that. So let's jump in with a discussion about truth and fake news and how we can know whether something is true or false. Recently, a climate report was released that was commissioned by Congress. It was put together with scientists from, I think, 13 different federal agencies. And the thrust of the report was this warning about the intensifying risks that are coming from global warming. And President Trump's reaction was to say that he's not a believer in the report, in the risks as they've been identified. And he said something really interesting just this morning in criticizing the Federal Reserve's interest rate policy.
Mm-hmm.
He said about his own gut instincts, "My gut tells me more sometimes than anybody else's brain can ever tell me."
Well, that's probably true, but doesn't prove anything about what it tells him.
Thank you. Would you like to respond to this very interesting issue about what we can know and how we know it?
Well, I think, in fact, is President Trump's reaction to the report concerning global warming should be seen in relationship with his reaction to the report of the FBI concerning the Khashoggi murder.
Indeed.
Because in that case, also, he said he didn't believe it. Now, this is very interesting for another reason. Well, for another reason. This is very interesting because, so this is a government of a very rich, very modern, well-organized country, which has a lot of institutions, which has a lot of departments, which have a lot of services. And these services spend their time, a lot of their time, doing reports about important information in order for people who govern us to have relevant information to take the right decisions. Now, here is somebody who is the president of this country and who says of two reports, which were made by his own administration, that he doesn't believe them. Mm-hmm. And this is, I think, to be put in relationship, or at least very early on, when Trump was elected, I remember a news conference where he said, well, you know, presidents are supposed to receive security briefing every day. But he was a very intelligent man. So he didn't need a security briefing every day. Once a week would be enough. So all of this works together, I think. In other words, what is, I mean, of course, there's the question of he does not agree with the whole thing of global warming. He thinks that it's not true. He's part of the people who contest that. This to the side, there is an attitude which is that he's not interested in what his administration or the services of the country says. He is only interested in what he seeks. And that is the real problem.
Yeah.
Because modern countries are, you know, there's millions, hundreds of millions of people living in the United States. You cannot govern a country like that without very specific information about what is going on right and left. And if you're going to consider that you're not going to take that into account, then it certainly is a major problem.
Yeah, well, it does seem that he agrees with what already supports his position.
And it agrees with what suits him.
With what suits him. Yeah, it's this matter of, you know, his gut or his own opinion becomes much more real or more important than the scientific inquiry or the reports.
Yes, and I mean, his opinion is often, I mean, his opinion is not a question of belief, I believe. I think his opinion is a question of objective.
Mm.
What I mean by that is, I mean, it is clear. I mean, one of the reasons, for example, the GM has closed these plants in the United States, or is going to close them, is going to put all these people out of work. One of the reasons they invoke, and it's certainly true, is they lost $1 billion on the new tariffs.
Right.
But this is not in any way mentioned in any way in anything he has to say about the issue.
Right.
And that is important, right? And the same thing works with, I think, with global warming. To say that global warming is going to have dire effect on the economy of the United States and certainly of the world is to say something which is absolutely independent from the issue of what causes it.
Right, yeah.
It doesn't matter what causes it. Is it a direct intervention of God, or is it the consequence of what we're doing? Clearly, there are going to be consequences, and we have to prepare for those consequences.
One would think that one should, but it's this whole question of knowledge, Paul, which is really seems to call into question, because it isn't just Trump that is skeptical of science.
No.
Scientific reports. It's a pervasive mood or moment right now where people are just very skeptical and trust their own judgments more than the judgment of a expert. You know, experts have fallen into ill repute right now, which I'm sure you don't take personally.
No.
No, but it seems to be an odd moment right now that Trump is taking advantage of, really.
Well, or actually is a symptom of something which is bigger in a sense, which might be the thing which he likes less in the world, to imagine that he's the symptom of something else rather than being himself.
He's the sort of the sign.
Well, I mean, I think there's two dynamics, put it like that, involve in skepticism concerning knowledge, especially concerning certain issues. One is a long-term transformation of politics in the United States, but not only in the United States, but in the United States in particular, since anyway this is what we're talking about, which is that whatever people say is not to be understood as meaning what they say. It is to be understood as being taking position or an action in view of the goal which they're not telling us. Mm. So in other words, if you say you are, you believe in global warming, that's not what you mean. What you mean is you're looking for a certain political objective.
Yes.
If you say you don't believe you're in global warming, again, you're not understood as saying this is what you believe. You're understood as taking a political position and working towards that goal. So in other words, whatever people say is not true.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because whatever people say, they don't mean it. They always mean something else than what they say. And this, of course, I mean, this, I think, from a Girardian point of view, is very clearly an effect of conflict.
Hmm.
We only see the opposite. The other person doesn't say the truth. The other person is looking to win, mm-hmm. to put it politely, in a less polite way. He's looking to screw me up.
Right.
And that's the point. So yeah. Once we look at the world like that, then there is no place for truth. And that, I think, is a fundamental problem. I mean, once we see the world, once we see whatever people say as moments in a conflict and a rivalry, there is no place for such a thing as truth. In the sense that we cannot see it. We have no access to it. We destroy our access to truth.
Because the what people say is just concealing an ulterior motive.
That's that what we think. That's the problem.
Yeah. Which
the
is...
One of the reasons of skepticism is to always, so to speak, double guess the other person.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? You always think the other person is not saying the truth. Oh, you're saying this, but actually I know what you really mean. You mean something different.
Huh. It seems to explain why our political conversations in the U.S. right now aren't conversations. They're just staking out a position and then defending it.
Yes, and that's, I agree. And that's why, you referred to my keynote address last year, it was earlier this year.
Yes.
It's not that long ago. I said, you know, terms like fake news, alternative facts, and so on, are accusatory terms.
Mm, mm-hmm.
They're not descriptive, they're accusatory. This is what we're doing. Whether it is Trump, whether it is Pelosi, it doesn't matter. Whenever people are saying such things as fake news, they are really saying, they're making an accusation on the other person.
Right.
And then, of course, when all our discourse becomes accusatory, then, of course, we're skeptical about everything. That's just part of it. So that, I think, is one of the reasons why so many people are skeptical about so many things, and not necessarily particularly about science, but about so many things. And I think this is due to a long-term, at least, I don't know, 10, 15 years, maybe less, but evolution of the American political scene, which has become much, much more confrontational. Yeah. In other words, we are not people who disagree about political issues, but are working together as members of the same country in order to make things better. We are enemies.
Yeah.
And once the political scene takes that structure, then, of course, progressively, it makes it that nobody knows what the truth is and nobody has access to it. And that is true. I mean, that is true. That is a situation which we all share, because there becomes a point where, yes, we don't know. In the sense that it's very hard to be able to, you know, as much as you try to be certain, because you don't know what the value of the information is. Because actually, once people start representing others like that, they also start, from a mimetic point of view, of acting how they imagine the others are acting. And therefore, they also act for ulterior motives and do not say what they are really believing. They are saying other things, which is why whenever somebody arrives now on the political scene and clearly is saying what he or she thinks, we think, wow, this is so great.
Yes, it's so refreshing.
Yeah.
For someone to be authentic and say what they're really thinking. Yeah. We're very, very suspicious. I find myself doing that. It's interesting now. I'm thinking about how I react when I'm in a, hear someone making a political statement. I'm always trying to figure out, where is it going? Why is he making that statement? And so I can't ever really address this, the what's right in front of me.
And
the conversation about it.
I agree. And it becomes extremely difficult also to do something else, which I think we need to do, which is to say, right, well, yes, this person is doing this because this person does have an ulterior motive, what I can see, because I know what is our long-term project is. But what immediately will be the consequence of this, that will be positive. And I should support it.
Right.
Right? But that requires that we take distance from our own commitments, in a sense.
And that's absolutely. Absolutely. I know. I often say that about, political persuasion here at Raven is very much liberal. And I like to say, you know, just because Donald Trump says it doesn't mean it isn't true.
No, and, of course. You know,
I mean, every once in a while, he says something very revealing that's quite true, which the example most recently is when he, on the Khashoggi, the CIA report on Jamal Khashoggi, he says, look, that may be true. It may not be true that the Saudi crown prince was involved, whatever. But you know what's more important is arms sales and the strategic relationship with Saudi Arabia and Israel. And so, you know, it doesn't matter that one guy got killed. And
he was really truthful there, I think, as far as his own opinion is concerned.
No, and about the historical relationship of our country with Saudi Arabia. It's always been strategic, and Saudi Arabia doesn't have clean hands. I mean, look at the war in Yemen that's been going on for so long.
For sure.
I mean, these things don't matter. And for Trump to come out and say it, I thought, bully for him. There you go. Now he's being very truthful. but you know, we call him a liar. And I don't know if he, is he a liar? Is he, I mean, your talk at the cover conference this summer was all about self-deception. And that's one of the things we like to debate about is Trump clever as a fox, or does he believe what he says, or is he, you know, manipulating us, or is he just self-deceived on all these issues, or, you know, trying to psychologize him.
Well, my opinion is that all of these are not exclusive alternatives. In other words, I think he's all of those things.
Depending on the topic, the issue at the
time. Well, depending on the topic, on the issue. Well, I mean, this is, Aristotle said, there's a thing from Aristotle which I like very much, which is that a liar or is not a person who never says the truth. Of course, he very often says the truth. And nor is an evil person somebody who never does any good.
Right.
And one of the things about, and especially about lying, it's important because one of the things about lying is that if you lie all the time, nobody will believe you. Right? And therefore, you will not lie.
Right.
Because lying is not just saying something which is false. Lying is actually an action which has consequences in the world. And it is, but if you lie all the time, then you can't do that action because you cannot have those consequences in the world. You will say something and nobody's going to be interested in it.
Right.
So lying successfully, which is what lying really is, requires not lying all the time.
Right.
Otherwise, it's not going to work.
Right.
So I think, you know, of course, you know, Trump says a lot of things which are true.
Yeah, he really does.
And then true also means, also true is an ambiguous term because, interestingly enough, because it can either mean, well, you know, to your left, there's a bookshelf, you know, that is true. Or to your right, there's a, or behind you, there are bookshelves and two chairs I can see. Maybe that is true, right? Mm-hmm. But then when we start talking about, for example, what we're talking about just a few minutes ago, relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia, and that it is true that they have always been strategic and so on. So we are sliding into a different conception of truth in which the truth is more like, well, this is the way it is in the sense that it has to be or should be or, right? It's very ambiguous. So we use the word true in two different sense, right, or meaning, and they're not entirely identical, even though, of course, they're related.
So you're in that
so example. What I'm saying is that even though it is true in a sense that it is a good description of the past policy of the United States with Saudi Arabia, that it has been very strategic, that it has closed its eyes or overlooked many of the bad things which Saudi Arabia has said, that it has, overlooked is a good thing. In other words, that it has been, therefore, extremely selective in its accusation of transgression of human rights, for example. Mm-hmm. That has always been the case. This is true. Now, is it true that this is the way but does that mean this is the way the United States should be running its policy? That's a different issue.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's a completely different issue.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's reminding me, you know, it's this connection between what's true and what might be just or right or good.
Yes.
A lot of times we equate truth and goodness or so forth, but that's not always the case.
No, something I don't think that's not the case.
Yeah.
But I mean, but clearly they are related.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
They are related in at least in the following sense. They are relating in the sense that you can only take a just position concerning the American or whatever policy towards Saudi Arabia to the extent that you are aware of the truth.
Yes.
I mean, you know, whether or not you want to continue having a certain type of relationship with Saudi Arabia, you know, is something which is a meaningful decision only if you know these people are transgressing human rights on a regular basis. And either you say, okay, we're going to swallow that snake, so to speak, and we're going to move in a certain way, or we're not going to do it. But certainly, if you just say, oh, no, it's only the Iranians who are transgressing human rights, then we are in a completely different figure.
Yeah.
Right? It's something completely different. We cannot take decisions the right way.
Exactly.
So, that relationship between truth and just is certainly fundamental.
Yeah, it is very important. And certainly the reputation that the United States has had or has tried to cultivate is a nation in which justice is very important, in which human rights are very important. And so this whole issue on, I wanted to ask you about the issue with Saudi Arabia and how that sort of played out internationally and how America's reputation is being affected. And it also, I think what's coming to mind on this issue too is the migrant caravan from Central America that's now, these refugees are now at our border with Mexico, and the way the Trump administration is responding to this, it's, you know, at the very least, there's bad optics, you know, of women and children being tear gassed at the border. And so, again, the America's reputation, we like to think of ourselves as a land of refuge, of human rights, of justice. And so I'm just wondering from your perspective, you know, what difference does America's reputation make in the world? And is it changing? Is it being damaged in some way right now?
Well, I think the American reputation in the world changed dramatically quite a while ago.
Hmm.
I think it changed dramatically when the United States decided to invade Iraq. I think that's when it changed dramatically. And people then saw the Americans not the same. I mean, many people in the world saw the Americans not the same as the people who were a country which was defending human rights, which was defending freedom, which was suddenly it appears as a country of lies.
Hmm.
In international policy, as a country which would, because, I mean, whatever you want to say about the invasion of Iraq, since the Second World War, an invasion is an illegal action. And the United States went out of their ways to convince the international community that they were not invading Iraq, that they were actually protecting themselves. It turned out that there were no weapons of mass destruction. And in that case, something also important happened, which is related to what is happening now, is that at that point, there was a government agency which presented these humongous reports about weapons of mass destruction. Nobody found them. So mm-hmm. We were already working. So this is a long-term process, right? This is not something which happened yesterday. That's why I said he's a symptom of something much more than he is. I mean, of course, he's an actor in this, but he's also a symptom of a long-term process. And I think what is happening now with the as far as the Americans' international reputation is concerned, you said earlier, well, you know, he said the truth. And you know what? I think a lot of people are thinking exactly the same thing. Well, you know, he said the truth. He said, look, we don't care about human rights. Mm-hmm. We care about weapon sales. That's what we care about. That's what my administration, that's what I care about. And in a sense, people say, yes, this has always been the case, what the Americans were caring about and nothing else. So therefore, for the reputation, it simply kind of confirms, I think, the international collapse, is the way I would describe it, of the American reputation as being upholders of certain moral values.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what it does. I don't think it changes it. I think that change has started quite a while ago. I think what it does is that it confirms what people have been thinking for the last 5 or 6 or more years. And the Obama administration was seen as an attempt, not entirely successful, but an attempt to move away from that and to re-give to the American this kind of international prestige. And to some extent, it succeeded, but to some extent only, because it also had its own share of dubious decision in terms of international politics, right? Mm-hmm. There's no problem about that. But nonetheless, the feeling was that we were moving in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
Now the feeling is that we are not moving, that it was just a little bump in actually what is the truth or what is the long-term evolution. But again, people don't see it as an evolution, right? Maybe that's the thing about the reputation of the United States that will be important, is that people don't really see it as an evolution. They rather see it as actually just a confirmation of what a lot of people believed.
Hmm.
Because if the American reputation was to some issue, you know, from the point of view of Europe was seen, and, you know, and Canada was, a good reputation. A lot of countries had very negative point of view on the Americans. And if you look at it historically, since the end of the Second World War, the Americans have been engaged, especially I've been engaged in some extremely, extremely controversial, to say the least, if not, you know, unacceptable international activities. I mean, they did support, and we know they only support, but they furnished the Indonesian government a list of people to eliminate when there was what was called the killing field, which was a major genocide which took place in the 1960s in Indonesia, and with the support of the Americans and the Australians also. So, you know, like, yeah, I mean, a lot of people know the American politics has been, you know, extremely centered on our own interests for a long time, but nonetheless, to a large part of the world, there was a real question of, there was the issue that, you know, they were defenders of certain, and to some extent, it was true in certain areas. It's just that there were different areas of the world, and, you know, everybody is equal, but some people are more equal than others.
Right.
The same.
Well, yeah. And it certainly does seem that the concern for human rights is, just a playing card in a bigger,
yes,
down the road, so. In the way we've been talking about it.
Yes, I think that's the case. Yeah. I think that's the case. And I think also, and that is why, as a lot of people have said, human life is not worth, not all human life are worth the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
So does what?
But I should add that this is not proper to the American government or anything, right? In other words, like that, there's a very famous sentence by Mitterrand many, many, many years ago, which was actually, there's an article of Le Monde which reports it, where he said about when the Rwandan genocide was taking place, he said to journalists, you know, they are a genocide. It's not something that is as important everywhere.
Wow.
So, you know, that's pretty strong. He was saying the truth also, one could say.
Very true, but not just.
It, right.
Absolutely. Yeah. So does this the American self-image is not eroding as fast as our reputation abroad, I would say.
No, I don't think, I think you're right. I think it is not. I think you're right.
Yeah.
I was going to say, even though the many, many people are aware of the division of the country,
mm-hmm.
and how acrimonious political discussion have become, right? That's important.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So the loss of maybe the veneer of America as being the beacon of truth and justice and human rights, the loss of that veneer over, I do think your assessment of the Iraq, that was a turning point. The Iraq war is pretty spot on. Does it matter? What impact does this have now, or is it having on America's ability to act internationally, to affect other countries? Positions on things, I mean, or should we care about that? I don't know.
Okay. Well, what effect does the American reputation have is the question, in a sense, right?
Yeah.
And I think it has an effect, but I don't think it has in effect, a short-term effect in that sense. I mean, as far as the short-term is concerned, what is involved is more, you know, immediate decisions, moving troops this here or there and so on, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I think it has a long-term decision or a medium-term decision in terms of trust. Especially the relationship with the Europeans, I mean, is very, very, you know, is getting extremely difficult. And there's a question of trust there, which is really important. Like people say, well, you can't trust the United States, right?
Right.
And mm-hmm. again, this is not, this is something which is longer term than the, than this administration. I mean, it goes as far back as the beginning of the 20th century, right after the First World War, when actually the Society of Nations was an American initiative.
Right.
And then they decided not to sign it. Well, that's interesting. And that is related to the structure of the American, which is that of the American government, which is that even though the president may commit himself to say, yes, we're going to do this, it has to be voted by Congress. And Congress can say, no, we're not going to do this. So that has always created a certain, you know, put the American in a tricky or a different position as far as international commitments were concerned. But the particularity of this administration is that it says, we've had a commitment, not anymore. We're going to change our mind.
Right.
That was it for Iraq. That was it for the TPP, the Trans-Pacific, you know. So all these things, right? You know, well, yeah, fine. But, and people think rightly or wrong that, you know, people think there's moral reasons to do this. Let me give you an example, which is related to Canada. The Harper government before the Trudeau, which was a conservative government. Harper was described as the last political survivor of the Bush era at some point. And he had signed a very large arms contract with Saudi Arabia. Look at that. How strange. Those guys have a lot of money to buy weapons. And the Trudeau government honored it. Even though people and the supporters of the Trudeau government were against it.
Yeah.
Now, here, I think there is, I mean, of course, one could say, it was for money, blah, and things like that, but I'm not quite sure about that. Mm. I think there was, on the part of this government, the idea that if you have international commitments, you honor them, period.
Right.
And it's not because, even though you may not like it, because that is part of the stability of the recognition of the country in terms of international agreements. And it is clear now that what is happening is, apart from the reputation in terms of are they good or are they bad, the idea that the United States cannot be trusted because they will regain on their, you know, come back on their agreement tomorrow because somebody else is going to be elected president or because this one changes his mind from one day to the next, right?
Right.
So that is a real issue. That really changes the ability of the United States to act in the world, to have allies, to have helpers, to do things. That's mm-hmm. clear. That is fundamental.
Yeah. Does it not to throw in another big issue, but the whole competition that's going on right now with China and the tariffs and the trade war, such as it is, there seems to be a lot of gamesmanship going on here. It's hard to know what the end game is. You know, what does Trump want? Again, you know, we're coming back to this. How do you trust what someone's saying when, you know, first, oh my gosh, and talking about trade, and he was saying he was going to close the border with Mexico and disrupt trade that way, and then disrupting trade with China. I feel like part of being a world power is that you have to project this invincibility on the world stage so people don't challenge you. In a way. And China is, I think, right now are a big challenger certainly economically, militarily too. I don't even know. What do you see about this dance that's going on right now between the U.S. and China?
Well, there's two aspects to this, right? Again, at least two aspects. One is the tariff war. The other one is the political situation of China, right? Mm-hmm. As far as the tariff war is concerned, again, to go back to an earlier part of our discussion, I think I think this might be a place where the answer to the question, is it ideological or, you know, what Trump really believes? Yeah, I think that is ideological and that is what he really believes. He really is economically a person of 30 years ago. He believes in closing border. He does not believe in globalization. He believes in tariff. He thinks that will protect the Americans. I mean, mm-hmm. I think he does think that. Mm-hmm. And that's why that's one of the reasons why he's acting like that. And he's finding other people who think, yeah, that's not mm-hmm. such a bad idea. So of course, then this is, and because these tariffs, they don't only concern the Chinese, they concern Europe, they concern Canada, they concern everybody, right? That's not a big, I mean, there's a few exceptions, but overall they concern everybody. So that's one thing. The other thing is the relationship of China with the United States or the growth of China as a world power. Mm-hmm. So the growth of China as a world power, in a sense, is clear, right? I mean, the Chinese are getting richer, more powerful. They have a bigger they have a very large army. They have a lot of people. How good they are, we don't know. You know, they lost, I don't know, it was a while, but they did lose a war against Vietnam, which is a little bit excessive. It's hard to know. It's really hard to know. Because to some extent, what the Chinese are doing is they're doing with the area of the world where I'm living, and especially the sea surrounding us, they're doing what the Americans did in the 19th century and the early 20th century, but mostly in the 19th century already, with South America, Latin America. Hmm. Which is to say, I mean, the Americans around the end of the 19th century pretty much said to Europeans, look, Latin America is our backyard, keep off. And the Chinese are saying, look, Taiwan, Korea, Philippines, Eastern Asia, that's our backyard. Leave it alone. Hmm. Keep off. So I think there is part of that which is going on. So the Chinese are just kind of like showing everybody else that they are the central power in this part of the world. They are also being active on a more international scene, in particular in Africa, where they are very active economically. They are also taking advantage of the loss of power of the Americans, right? You know, mm-hmm. that is really, in other words, one way of putting it is that the world had one hegemon, which was the United States. But mm-hmm. now that's not the case anymore. There's at least two. There's at least the Chinese. And now it's getting a much more complex world, a world where there are international actors, more than only one, so to speak, and all the little guys around. Right. Especially because there was a period after the end of the Soviet Union, then after its collapse, then the only real world power was the United States. And then this was a very simple world in a way, in which there was the United States and all these other guys who were not powerful enough. But now we're going back to a situation of international relation where you have sources of power which are quite important and more than one. And the United States is really, its own power is being reduced, among other things, because it is, how can I say, it extended itself a lot You know, the idea that, and there was a report recently that the United States might have problems winning a war against China. But the scenario is, so can the United States successfully win a war simultaneously against the Chinese, the Russian, and be involved in the Middle East, right? Well, my feeling is, why would they want to do that? Why would they want to do that? In other words, what is so terrible that they wouldn't be able to do that, right? Our conversation, many aspects of our conversation in, you know, are linked together. It is true that for a long time, the United States did think of themselves and were thought by a lot of people as the, in French, you see, the gendarme du monde, the policeman of the world.
Yes, yeah.
But that is certainly disappearing, or has disappeared.
For sure. Well, it was certainly something President Trump said, we're not doing that anymore.
Yeah.
Well, I'm conscious of the time, and I want to just get your thoughts on one more subject that we could keep going on this one for a while. Mm-hmm. And that is the relationship between the Trump administration and the judiciary here in the United States.
Yes.
There's been a lot of cases brought against the administration. He's won some, he's lost a lot. And recently, after the a decision by the Ninth Circuit Court that went against the administration in their efforts to keep migrants from entering the U.S. while they were applying for asylum, that the court ruled against President Trump, and he just dismissed it and said, well, that's an Obama judge. You know, there's Obama judges and there's Trump judges. And Chief Justice Roberts, in a rare move, made a public statement and said, there's no such thing as Obama judges and Trump judges. We are just interpreting the law, which was an interesting statement in itself. But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about this way Trump has of attacking judges and attacking, you know, really personal attacks on judges that go against, that render decisions against him. And what's the effect of that, sort of weakening, if you will, the reputation of the courts?
The United States, or modern democracies, not just the United States, countries which have the rule of law, have three powers, right? The judiciary, the executive, and the legislative. What we were saying before concerning truth and concerning conflict and was that what everybody says is part of a conflict with my political enemy. Mm-hmm. People are not saying the truth. Now, when Trump says this is an Obama judge, he's saying exactly that. He's saying this judge is simply my political enemy. Mm-hmm. Therefore, he is saying there's not three powers. There's no judiciary which is independent and separate from the executive and the legislative. There is only political power and political conflicts. And when Justice came in to say, no, there are no Obama judges, there are only judges, he was reasserting, which is why he came, clearly, which is why he intervened, just reasserting the independence of the judiciary in relationship with the rest of the political situation.
Right.
I think that's very clear. So, but I think it is part of the same evolution in which there is no possibility to speak a language or to say anything which is not immediately interpreted as being part of a political conflict. That is because, so instead of saying, the judge has just said, well, you know, the law does not allow me to do that, then the law does not allow me to do that, period. It is just saying, no, this person is part of the Democrats. And he is actually, he has a political agenda. So it is the same, it is in a sense the same dynamic as we were talking before. It is just another example of that same dynamic.
Right. And a sort of a frightening one, where it's this, you know, Girard talks about the escalation of a mimetic crisis and of rivalries, and it begins to consume all aspects of the community. And well, this is an example of that, I'm guessing.
I agree with you 100%. This is a perfect example of what Girard says when he says that conflicts destroys differences.
Indeed.
Because instead of having a difference between the executive, the legislative, and the judiciary, you have only a conflict between us and them. That's all that's left.
That's all that's left.
That's all that's left. I mean, that's not true that this is what, you know, has happened, because, I mean, in the United States, the institutions survive and so on. There's no problem. But what I mean is that this is the frame of mind which is present here. That is, it is exactly that frame of mind. And that is what is so dangerous, because, not because, it's not dangerous because Trump is an evil person who will do terrible things. It is dangerous because people start to think like that.
Right.
Everybody starts to think like that. And once everybody thinks like that, then it does become the crisis. Then there is no way out.
Right.
That's the problem. That is the real issue, I think. That's the real danger. The danger is that it is contagious. It is contagious. So that's why, you know, when the Chief Justice comes out and says, we don't want to play this game, he's right. And that's the important thing to say. We do not playing this game. Nobody's playing this game. He did not only say there's no Obama judge. He says there's no Bush judge, there's no Clinton judge.
Yes.
Which I think is right, you know. In other words, we don't care. And you can report that to the election of what's his name on the Supreme Court?
Oh, Kavanaugh. The Kavanaugh hearings? Yeah.
Yes, that's exactly what, I mean, what happened again was that, right? But of course, there's an old tradition there going on. But what happened again was that, right? Was the idea that it was all a political decision, and his own defense really had that structure, right? You know.
Yeah. Well, it's that's been the gradual trajectory of the. The court appointments for the last couple of administrations, they've been so highly politicized that there's it's all Republicans vote one way, Democrats vote another. There's no consensus on the judges, which then again just sets up this impression.
Which then goes into the direction of saying there's Obama judge in there. So you can see that it's a dynamic, right? It's not just what one person is doing. It's a recurring process which leads to bad consequences, I think.
Right. Yeah, no, it's true. And I think that we need to be really conscious of how important it is to maintain those differences between the branches of government, and that these kinds of things, we can't just laugh them off, really. I mean, you're right now to say we're in pretty good shape, but a sustained movement in this direction where the impartiality of the judiciary gets, you know, that we can't trust them anymore. To say, if Europe can't trust us to keep agreements, if the rest of the world, you know, it is in a sense a lot about trust.
It is a lot about trust and trust is, it's fundamental in this issue. And it is about being able to hear what other people are saying.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and not just to take what they're saying, as I said, as an action, which has an ulterior motive.
Right. Yeah, I think that is, you know, my hope is that, I mean, I don't know how we pull ourselves back from this sort of suspicion and skepticism about each other's motives and so forth, so that we can begin to have conversations again about issues and about things that matter. I mean, how do you pull back from these sorts of things, dynamics?
Well,
this is where I bring in the James Allison for some spiritual advice, right?
Yeah. But I mean, one of the evident answers is just stop doing it. I think, but I mean, that sounds ridiculous in a way, but I think actually it is really fundamental. Mm-hmm. It is really fundamental to just stop playing that game and therefore take a chance. Because, you see, we said it's a question of trust. But what is trust? So we tend to think that trust is belief in other person. Right? In other words, I trust you. In other words, I believe you will do this or that, or I believe what you say, but I trust you. Well, I personally don't think that's a very good way of saying trust, actually. I think trust is an action. And you trust somebody when you take an action which is such, in your relationship with that person, which is such that it makes you vulnerable to that other person. That's when you trust. And therefore, when you say, you know, I'm going to trust, then it means you offer yourself, in a sense, to be vulnerable, right?
Yeah.
And you don't offer yourself to be vulnerable because you want to be hurt. You offer yourself to be vulnerable because there's something to be gained from doing that. And you also offer yourself to be vulnerable because, in a different way, or a different sense of the term, you trust yourself. Which means you are not afraid. You don't think you will die from this. You don't think you will be destroyed entirely by this. You're ready to swallow if it doesn't work. So, you know, the idea that, you know, we are brave, we don't trust, this is ridiculous to me. No, you are brave when you trust. In other words, when you are ready to take a chance, because that's what is involved, right? Mm-hmm. But take a chance, not just take a chance. I mean, you trust when, as I say, when you make yourself vulnerable to your action in a way in which you would not be otherwise. What is it? What do you do? This is very clear. Like, when you trust somebody with one of your secrets, what does it mean? It means precisely that. Mm-hmm. You make yourself vulnerable to that person, which you didn't have to. Mm-hmm. But that's what trusting is, I think.
Right.
So, yeah. So I think trust is important, but trust has to be understood not just of, oh, I can't believe in him, therefore I won't trust him, right?
Uh-huh.
It has to be, you know, I will trust. It's an action. It's not just a question of belief, right?
Is it a way to think about it as a willingness to lose, where winning isn't the most important thing?
Well, I think it's not necessarily a willingness to lose. And so I'm ready, but it's a, well, I don't know. I mean, it depends what willingness means. Maybe I'm obsessed by the term, by the will aspect there.
Yes.
I don't want to lose. I don't want to lose, but, and in fact, not only I don't want to lose, but actually, if there is any belief concern, I believe that, in a sense, I will gain more, even if I lose this.
That's the paradox of it. Yeah.
Because when you trust, you you step back to jump further, so to speak. You're ready to right. step back to jump further, right?
Exactly. Yeah, I was just at a conference of people who engage in unarmed civilian protection, protecting mm-hmm. civilians, and they're unarmed and they use nonviolent methods. And mm-hmm. this one line's just been sticking out at me that says, when you practice nonviolence, you have to lose before you win.
Yeah.
You will suffer humiliation. People will call you names because you're engaging in a culture that practices dominance and, you know, it's our normal conflict zone where we're just trying to beat one another. And you're entering into it in a way that says, well, I care more about our relationship than I do about winning.
Right.
You know? And you're going to look like a loser, you know, and your reputation will suffer. Maybe that's a good thing in the long run. But yeah, I think that it does take a bit of.
See, well, you just said the reputation might suffer. Maybe that's a good thing in the long run. Maybe it is also for the United States.
Yeah, I wonder. It could be. That's right. That's a book.
Well, you know,
that's
you
it.
I did it, right?
No, you're going to write it. But well, thank you very much. I really appreciate this. It was a very, very meaningful conversation. We covered a lot of topics, and my hope meter went up and down all through the whole thing. But I'm ending on a hopeful note, and mostly hoping that you'll come back and do this again with us.
Sure.
Real soon. Thanks so much, Paul. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.